Welcome to the 11th episode of the Peas in the Podcast, Season 3. By now, you should know the drill. Here, we discuss trends and provide commentary on media and social justice issues, as well as our own personal life experiences. Please remember to hashtag wear your mask and get the vaccine. On today's episode, we've got a solo episode with me, Star, and my dear friend, Abby. And Abby, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks. Hi, I'm Abby Chow. I'm a marriage and family therapist and ADHD specialist. And I also have a website and podcast called The ADHD Manual.
Awesome. So Abby and I became friends in college many years ago. I was just texting someone tonight who was like, college feels like a million years ago, and I said, but yet it feels like 3 years ago all at the same time. Maybe that's because I haven't gone to grad school, and I'm just like, the last fun times I had were in college before I had to pay bills and got diabetes. It's like that was my last taste of freedom. So Abby and I met in college. We were both involved in the theater program at our school, and we became friends, and we've just been connected ever since. And I actually have Abby to thank for my pursuing an ADHD diagnosis this past year, which, I mean, I don't really know if I've really talked about this on the podcast. I'm sure I've like offhandedly mentioned it, but as a kid in seventh grade, I was diagnosed with ADD. And of course, that was 2001, and it was kind of like every kid who couldn't really sit still was getting hit with an ADD diagnosis at that moment in time. And I'm sure Abby can really get into the nitty-gritty of that if we really wanted to, about like what that looked like back then versus what the diagnosis process looks like now. But I was medicated for a little bit, and but I didn't like the medication, and my parents didn't really like the medication that I was on. It made me grouchy, or it made me hungry, or it made me tired, but it never made me happy or active, which I guess is partially the point. As an adult, I always knew that like I had ADD, but I didn't really know what the cultural shift was between ADD and ADHD. So I think that's kind of what I want to start talking, like start off our conversation with. Abby, like, what is the history there of this shift that we saw happen between like every kid was getting diagnosed with ADD to only a few kids were, quote unquote, a few kids were getting diagnosed with ADHD?
Yeah, good question. Let's see. Well, I think one of the kind of myths about ADHD is that it's overdiagnosed, especially in kids, which is not completely accurate. I'm sure that there are pockets where that's true. But I think in general, the facts are that people are getting more so diagnosed with ADHD now than they were before. So diagnosis has increased. And the reason for that is, I don't know if it's debated per se, but I know that a lot of people say that it's rather because of, you know, how much we're learning about it and, how much more we know about, how ADHD looks in people who are assigned female at birth. People of color are getting more so diagnosed now that, so a lot of populations were missed before. So it might be true that overdiagnosis was happening in like, you know, little white boy populations. But I think in general, the diagnosis is increasing because we're learning more about it and learning that it doesn't, that it's actually much, much bigger than hyperactivity and inattention and that it's really poorly named. So I think that's part of it. The cultural question is an awesome question. I love that. I want to sit on that. I think that maybe the neurodiversity movement is getting more traction now. That might be one of the shifts. I think there's also a shift in, and I could say more about what that is in a second, but I think there's also kind of a shift in just how we're forming communities and the validity of self-diagnosis in those communities. So yeah, so and I think that's partly because of the neurodiversity movement and the recognition that the diagnosis tools that are often pushed are not really as reliable as we were told that they are. So it's just kind of all over the place. And I think it's a lot of, we don't really have good diagnosis measures. And they tend to vary, you know, dramatically because, you know, the neuropsychological evaluation is pushed a lot. A lot of people think that's the only way to diagnose it, and that's not true. And those evaluations are very expensive and difficult to access, especially if you're part of a population that's been disenfranchised, disadvantaged, neglected. So I think that's part of it. But neurodiversity, what that is the idea that basically there's no wrong neurotype, that, you know, we need all different types of brains, and that neurodivergence, such as like learning disabilities, ADHD, autism, any kind of mental illness, really, any kind of different brain, is all like a natural diversity in human brains in general, and that we kind of need all of them. And it kind of seeks to stray away from the medical model of like pathologizing and with disordered language and deficit language. And so I think that's gaining more traction culturally. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. No, it definitely did. Thank you. I shared a little bit about my journey as a kid. I think your story of really coming to your diagnosis is really fascinating. Would you mind sharing some of that with us?
Yeah, definitely. So I was diagnosed as an adult, and not that long ago, probably like 3 or 4 years ago. And I think I got lucky. I mean, I became a therapist before I was diagnosed. So like, by nature of working with it a lot, and I had a friend and a coworker who I had helped to like, I encouraged him to get diagnosed with ADHD. And then after that happened, I moved out here and I was in my first full-time therapy job. In the past, that like it was like the only full-time job I've ever had. I was always doing like several jobs at once. You know, I had a lot of part-time stuff and a lot of hourly stuff and internships, obviously, and things like that. So it was my first full-time job, and I was just casually commenting to him. I was like, I feel so foggy. Like everything feels like unclear, and I feel like it's taking all my energy to like focus my eyes, you know, essentially, and like focus my thoughts and clear through like the mental clutter. And then he was like, that sounds like ADHD. and I was like, oh, I guess. Yeah. And then when I started reading more about it, specifically Attitude Mag was a huge resource for me. They have a lot of great articles about how it presents in different populations, and a lot of the characteristics of ADHD that are not in the diagnosis process, like emotional dysregulation, for example. It's huge. Pretty much everybody with ADHD has some sort of emotional dysregulation, and it's not in the DSM or the manual we use to diagnose mental illnesses. So, So once I found out more about that and more about like rejection sensitivity, emotional dysregulation, what it looks like in women, and all that kind of stuff, it really started to come together for me. And then I just saw a psychiatrist, and I had just moved to Seattle. I had been on psych meds already, so I needed her to take over a lot of it. But I mentioned that to her, and I was like, I think I have ADHD. Like, I think that's, you know, my therapist, I work with it a lot. I've been researching a lot, and it just really seems to fit a lot of what I'm dealing with. And basically she was like, yeah, I agree. That sounds right. You know? And then put me on meds. So I really, really got lucky. I think it's kind of rare. to be able to just, yeah, be listened to in that way and be, you know, have a provider willing to take a chance on that and basically believe what I was saying. So, yeah. So that's what happened. And I got on meds, and once I got on ADHD meds, I was able to, like, cut down on a lot of the other psych meds I was taking. One of them I stopped taking entirely because I was like, I think I was taking this for what it's not. It was Zoloft. And I was like, I don't think I'm depressed. I think I had ADHD. That's pretty much where I'm at today. And then after that, and after I spent so much time, researching it for my own gain and my own knowledge, I kind of fell into the specialty, and it just happened to be that a huge chunk of my caseload at a substance use transitional housing program, huge amount of my caseload had ADHD as well. So I kind of just fell into it in that way, and it's kind of been my life ever since.
Wow. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I'm in a Facebook group. I'm in a few like ADHD centered Facebook groups. And in one of the groups last week, somebody was like, I'm starting to seek diagnosis. I'm really overwhelmed. Can somebody just like tell me, like literally tell me how you got diagnosed, like what your steps were? Oof. And I was like, it was so interesting to see the variety of answers, because I was very similar to your experience. My therapist and I, well, you and I talked about it a little bit, and I like started seeing memes online, and I was like, okay, this makes sense. And I always knew that there was something like off about my brain ever since I was a kid. But also like working in a school with learning services really helped me kind of realize like, oh, some of the struggles that these students are having in the learning lab are struggles I had as a high school student, and I still have. That might mean something's happening here. So I mentioned it to my therapist, and my therapist is a Black woman, and she's amazing. And she just, anytime I say something and she decides she's going to like run me through a questionnaire, she gets really quiet and she gets this like very concentrating look on her face. We have therapy virtually, and I'll see her like clicking around on her computer, and then she'll ask me the questions in a way that makes it seem like she's coming up with them on her own, just out of the blue.
What a sneak.
Right. She's so great. I love her so much. And she was like, Starleisha, do you ever feel? And then she like read me the first question, and I was like, yes. And we went through like, I don't know, it was maybe like 7 questions. And we got to the end, and we were both kind of like cracking up. And she was like, yeah, she's like, I can't like really formally diagnose you, but I think you definitely have ADHD. And I was like, yeah, I know. Like, I know. And she's like, all right, I'm going to refer you to a psychiatrist. And I went to the psychiatrist appointment, and the guy was so like abrupt. And I hate that. And he was very much like, he ran me through the depression questionnaire. It was like, are you sad? Do you have friends? Are you lonely? Do you have family? Like, da da da. And I'm like, this was November of last year. So we were what, like 7 months into a pandemic that nobody knew anything about. And I was like, yes, I'm sad. Yes, I'm depressed. We are going through a collective trauma. Also, not to mention, I'm a Black woman living in the like most racist modern time of America. So yeah, it's all awful. And by the end of that conversation, he was like, all right, I'm going to prescribe you some Zoloft and something else, and that'll help with the anxiety and depression. And I was like, I don't think I'm depressed, though. I was like, I don't like that. So I ended up calling my primary care, who's also a Black woman. And I was like, yo, Dr. H Day. Oh, she went to Messiah, by the way.
No way.
Whoa. Yeah. Tierra Heisey. She's amazing. I'm just like doxing myself. But if anybody in the central PA region needs a primary care physician, Dr. Heisey James is like the best. I love her. So I like messaged her and I was like, something weird happened at this psychiatry place. I don't really know what's going on. Can we talk about this? I think I have ADHD and I think I am like looking for a diagnosis. And she messaged back another questionnaire and it was like maybe 18, 20 questions. And I filled it out real quick and I sent it back and she was like, yeah, she's like, you have ADHD. Here's a prescription. Your meds will be ready in like 2 days.
Wow.
And I was like, fascinating. Oh, okay. Like, all right. Like it didn't have to be this hard. And then I went back to my therapist and I was like, yeah, you were right about that psychiatry place, because she gave me the names of a few places and a couple of them had a really long waiting list, except for the place that I went to. And she was like, I've heard not great things about this place, like before I called them. And I was like, yeah, you were right. Like that guy was trying to put me on like antidepressants. And she was like, yeah, you do not need that. Like, I'm your therapist. I know you, like we've known each other for X amount of years. She was like, it's ADHD, not severe depression. So it's really interesting that that kind of happened with you, where you saw some of that, like, you saw yourself being able to let go of being on Zoloft because your ADHD meds just kind of flipped everything, right?
Yeah. And I was on it for a long time, like wow. All through grad school and a little bit after. So yeah, 3 or 4 years maybe.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was really cool. Yeah. Wow. So fascinating. You had like every diagnostic experience.
Yeah,
that's
I did.
So interesting. Yeah, yeah. And I hear that a lot because therapists can diagnose. They can formally mm-hmm. diagnose ADHD. It's just a matter of if, you know, prescribers will accept it and if like other right. powers that be will take it. Fascinating. Did you, I didn't hear you mention like during the diagnostic process as an adult, I didn't hear you mention that you were diagnosed as a kid. Did you bring that up to people? Did that factor
I did.
In?
Yeah, I told my therapist about it because she and I had been talking about this for like a while because, I mean, childhood trauma, but also like I took that chemistry class a few years ago and I struggled so badly. And just having conversations with the women in the learning lab at school, I was like, okay, I definitely have some sort of learning difference that relates to math, but I didn't know how to put words to it. And throughout that whole, like taking that chem class process, I was in therapy and every week I was just stressed out about it. And she was like, you gotta do this. And I was like, I don't know what to do because I don't know if it's a learning disability. I know for sure it's ADHD, but I don't have a formal diagnosis, so I can't seek reasonable accommodations within the classroom. I don't even know what that would look like, especially as an adult learner at a community college. I was like, I don't know. There's like a big difference between, there's like a big gap, right? Like between the resources that are available to you in high school and the resources that are available to you as a traditional college student. And then the resources that are available as a non-traditional adult learner. Yeah. And I'm just like, I think our local community college is pretty decent, like whatever. But I went to tutoring, which didn't help. The tutor and I just could not figure things out together because I needed deeper, more like structural, systemic like assistance. So yeah, like my therapist knew that I had been diagnosed as a kid, and I mean, and excuse me, hand in hand with my ADD diagnosis was also really, really low functioning. Oh my golly, what's the word? Not yes, motor skills, but low functioning hand eye coordination. Really poor depth perception, really, like I had occupational therapy from age, gosh, 7 to 10, I think. And I just found out literally 2 years ago, my mom told me 2 years ago, 'cause it was during chemistry. She was like, yeah, we, she's like, we, when we finished occupational therapy, the doc, it was through my eye doctor. She was like, the doctor told me that you hadn't made the progress he had hoped you would have in that amount of time, but there wasn't anything else he could do. And I was like, are you joking me? Like, I was like, I'm 30 years old and you're telling me this now? Like, this would have been helpful information to know going into college. This would have been helpful information to know, like, just being an adult in general. I was like, I always knew I was a bad driver, but if you had just told me outright, the eye doctor doesn't think it's safe for you to drive, then that would have, like, caused me, like, that would have saved me a lot of additional trauma from, like, not having a driver's license. Yeah. So, you know, there's like also, all what sorts
a
of
bummer thing to say about a kid though. Like, oh my God. You can't end something like that. Jeez.
Right? Like, thanks, Dr. Yurgaitis. I really appreciate the help. Like, so awful.
Interesting. That's so funny because I'm in a training right now. Because I need to take continuing education about ADHD to maintain my certification. And I do it every 2 years and it's due next week. So naturally I'm doing that now. And so I have to take 20 hours of training. Yeah, but I'm in one right now that's talking about, a huge link between, she's a speech and language pathologist. So like language impairment and, ADHD and autism. And it's really fascinating. And she talks a lot about that, about how like there's a lot of overlap between, struggles in some types of skills and communication skills and language skills and motor skills and ADHD.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Just kind of thinking about all the things that I've struggled with in life and most of them are math and science related. Like that's literally the reason I don't have a college degree is because I couldn't pass a math or science class to save my life or with a cheat sheet. Like I just couldn't do it. So yeah, there's like lots of interesting links there that I think people are finally like it's being demystified a little bit and like unstigmatized a bit.
Yeah. Learning differences. ADHD is a huge overlap. And did I ever, I sent you Renee Brooks' website, right?
Yes. Black Girl Lost Keys. Everybody check out Renee Brooks. She is
phenomenal.
Awesome.
But she has that great, I think I did send you this article, the vertical heterophoria, the eye condition that also coexists with ADHD a lot.
I think you did send it to me. You did, right? I'm not sure if I read it, but I think you did.
It's fair.
Or I saw it somewhere on the internet. I'm in the Facebook group she created. So ooh, cool. if anyone out there is listening and you identify as a Black woman or, a non-binary person, there's a Facebook group called, let me find it, Unicorn Squad.
Oh, that's
for
so cute.
Black people of marginalized genders with ADHD. That's what it is.
Awesome. Oh, I'm so glad you're in that. I've heard stuff about it and I was, excited.
It's so great and it's really funny and it's awesome because there are things that like, there are very specific Black people related things. Like people are talking about like their hair washing, like wash day routines. Does anybody else feel like wash day is your most dreaded day of the week because you don't have the spoons to do it or your executive dysfunction is so high that you just are not like you just physically cannot wash your hair. And I'm like, yeah, I have that. But I also don't have the money to be getting weaves or braids every 3 to 4 months. Because I'm a Black woman living in America being underpaid. So it's like, you know, everything, it's all a cycle, right? Like, it's all connected.
Yeah. I'm very curious about, let me see. You don't have to answer this because you don't owe me any emotional labor. but I am really curious about the unique experience of being a Black woman with ADHD. And I imagine that differs quite a lot from my experience, and I'm very curious if you have any reflections on that.
I think my answer would be slightly different if I didn't have a Black woman therapist and a Black woman primary care provider. But I think, you know, there's like very specific differences, obviously, like the hair washing thing. And then, you know, there's, which thankfully I feel like millennial culture has moved away from the whole like work twice as hard, get half as much mentality that is very prevalent in the Black community. While that concept is definitely, unfortunately, still true, I see a lot more Black women and Black folks in general just really starting to recognize our worth and not being like, I'm going to put myself through hell to maybe make as much as my white male coworkers, right? And I think that kind of relates to ADHD as well, because there's a little bit of ableism in that, right? Of like, oh, just keep your head down, nose to the grindstone, get through your work day. You can't ask for help. Like all of those like negative things that often happen in corporate settings, or like, I mean, I've never worked a corporate job, but from what I hear, like in settings that are very high intensity and high demand. Another thing that kind of goes along with that, but isn't 100% the same thing, is the struggle of people not allowing Black women in particular to show heightened emotion, or like, you know, the instant your face changes, you become the angry Black woman and you then get doubly disrespected. So there's, of course, that interesting piece of emotional regulation or deregulation or both?
Dysregulation? I usually hear dysregulation, but yeah. Deregulate works too, I think.
Yeah. So there are those moments of like emotional dysregulation, and you know, that's traumatic to have a white person looking at you and being like, why are you getting so angry? It's like, well, I'm not necessarily getting angry. I'm finally learning to stand up for myself and advocate for myself, because we are the millennial generation. And I think the millennial generation of Black women are really good at that in specific ways that previous generations weren't. And then that can lead to like rejection sensitivity. So I think that everything, I mean, I'm just going to keep saying it, like everything is very connected. And especially for Black women, it's like, we already have so many things to worry about because we are underpaid, and we already have like just environmental things happening, cultural things happening. And then add on to that the fact that your brain wants to move in a direction that is different than other people's brains. And you have to like keep that in check, along with remembering to wash your hair or brush your hair or whatever else, so you can at least partially be the acceptable version of a Black woman in America. So,
yeah, that's a great point about emotions. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because the thing that I really struggle with and have my whole life and am just really being more explicit about it is always being someone with huge emotions, and how learning my whole life that was not okay. And like, it was not... And it was, you know, it was called dramatic and oversensitive and, you know, like volatile. And, you know, people were very afraid of my anger and my big feelings. And that's a great point to recognize that there's that level as a Black woman. There's also like, it's very dangerous sometimes to display those big emotions. That's a really good, there's a safety consideration too.
Yeah. Definitely.
I did have a question about, I've been thinking a lot about labels and like identity and like how the words we use to describe ourselves. And especially like listening to, I just listened to your episode with the three of you and Bonnie, which was awesome. And I heard you a lot of times, like you were talking about like work and you know, capitalism, having to work a lot, and the transition to working from home, things like that. And I heard you describe yourself as like just like a lazy person who doesn't really want to work, right? And I was just really intrigued by that and just really curious, like, it just got me thinking of, because lazy is actually a word that's banned in my house.
I've heard you talk about this on your podcast.
Yeah, yeah. We have to pay each other a dollar if we say it.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, because it was just such a huge part of my identity growing up, is that like I just always thought I was just inherently lazy. And it was so interesting that I'm just now, you know, I just turned 30 and I'm just now like coming, you know, into this realization that like, oh, actually, I have been working twice as hard as everybody, every neurotypical person, but I always thought I was like lazy and underachieving because I didn't produce as much as they did. So it's just really interesting to think about how my self descriptions have changed, or how I want them to change, now that I can see how much it relates to ADHD. I have a different word to describe it. Do you have anything like that? Like any self-perception that changed once you had more language?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so basic, but I have really tried to remove stupid from my vocabulary in general. But like, you know, the default for me, it was and still is sometimes like, chemistry class is just a really perfect example. Like, oh my gosh, I can't do this. I'm so stupid. Why can't I understand this problem that's laid out before me? I'm so stupid. But then I get in the lab and I'm killing it in the lab because I'm using my hands and I can clearly understand what I need to be. Like, I have an end result I'm supposed to be reaching, as opposed to seeing a problem with letters and numbers and words and being like, oh, I'm so stupid, I can't get it. And I think for me, anytime stupid or lazy or I can't enters my vocabulary, to me, that represents it's just my frustration. But now that I've been diagnosed, I can replace I'm stupid with I don't understand this. I can replace I'm lazy with maybe I just need 10 minutes to chill out and get over myself and then do what I need to do. And I can't kind of turns into I will try this, but if I'm not good, I'm not going to do it, you know, like, which is also not great. But I at least will put an I try before an I can't now. So yeah, that's been interesting. I mean, the biggest example of why I like have kind of shifted my mentality was one night I went in for tutoring before chemistry class. I sat down with a professor. We went through my homework and I literally got, I think like an 80 or 90 on the homework. And I had to go in and take a test right afterwards. The test was almost identical to the homework. And I failed that test with a 33%. And she came up to me after class and she was like, I don't understand, like, what happened between you and I sitting down and talking it through. She's like, you know this, Starlisha. And I was like, I know that I know this. You know that I know this. But I can't, because I was like, I literally cannot look at this paper by myself and work out these problems.
Yeah.
My brain cannot function like that. I was like, if you were to give me every single test this unit the way we did it and just had me explain the answers, I'd be blowing it out of the water. So like knowing that, and now having a formal diagnosis, if I were to ever go back to school and take another chemistry class, that would just be like day one, right? Like it's that thing of like being empowered. Like, okay, now I know that I'm not stupid. I never thought I was like actually stupid, but it's like now I know that I'm not stupid. My brain just works differently. And here's how I can help a professor or a choreographer or like my boss help me achieve the goals I need to achieve in this classroom, dance situation, or workplace setting.
Yeah, that's an amazing example of like a great accommodation too. That's a, yeah, perfect idea. Right. Yeah, I had to ask for accommodations for my my licensing exam in marriage and family therapy, and that was, yeah, that was new because I didn't do that in grad school or college or any schooling. So that was, yeah, it was weird, and I still, you know, it was still really hard. And now, like, I always say this story, and I think I've said it before on my own podcast too, because, like, I think it's really, I don't know, in case it would help somebody, because, like, what I asked for a separate testing environment and extra time. So I got that. And then when I got there, I found out that they had no, I couldn't wear any type of watch, even like a, you know, a plain old analog one. And there were no clocks in the room or in the hallway or in the bathroom.
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah. I freaked out because, like, you, because you had like 5 minutes to go to the bathroom. That was it. And, like, yeah, you, they would have to, like, throw out your test if you spent more than 5 minutes in the bathroom. And, like, I told the proctor, I was like, I don't know what 5 minutes is. I don't know. Like, I don't know what that feels like. And I don't, I can't just do that. Like, my really quick going to the bathroom could probably be longer than 5 minutes. I have no way of knowing. So I freaked out. And so I thought that's something that, like, if I had known that, I would have asked for an accommodation around clocks. Even just like, if, even if they provided a clock for me, it would have been better. Like, I don't have to bring my own to cheat on it, you know, just like, give me like a timer even. That would be great. So yeah, in case that helps anybody with also really bad time blindness.
Can we talk about time blindness? Because this is a concept I need every single one of my friends to understand about me.
Yeah.
And I don't, like, I want you to explain it because the way I explain it, I'm sure is also correct, but I hear myself explaining it sometimes and I'm like, this is the dumbest, like, this thing doesn't make sense, like, to me in my head.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is wild, and it, it affects everyone in different ways. I mean, for me, I think time blindness is probably the most impairing part of my ADHD. It really, really wrecks me in my daily life. So basically what it is that, you know, ADHD involves a dysregulation of dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter in your brain. And dopamine is always thought of as like the reward system chemical, you know, like you get like dopamine when you eat or have sex or, you know, do something great that you're supposed to keep doing, right? But they're discovering more and more how much depends on dopamine. And one of those is time perception. Like, they had a really interesting study or like a test on rats, and like, found that their ability to, let's see, what do they have to do? They had to, like, press a button at the right time or estimate how much time had passed. And if they pressed the button to correlate that they had guessed correctly or something, they got a treat or something like that. And they found that dopamine impacted that. Like, if, yeah, if they didn't have enough dopamine, then they would constantly miss, you know, misrepresent how much time had passed. So that makes a lot of sense when you say it that way, like it, and that really connected some dots for me because I was never been able to, and it's tough because like, I always had a watch, like that was one of my things as a kid, like that and, you know, never wearing jeans because I hated the feeling of the button. Like those two things were my, my identifying, like, you know, characteristics is I always had a watch because like, and I wore it so much and I checked the time so much. Like I was really good at estimating like what time it was, you know, like I could say like, I feel like it's like 4:35 and I'd be right, you know, but it's, that's totally different from sensing how much time has passed. And like, especially when you're doing something, cause like, and it really, you know, because we're so dysregulated and, you know, that's how we get the saying of like, time flies when you're having fun. Like that's real. Cause like the more you're having fun, the more dopamine you have. And that's, you know, and that's, you know, in flux and impacting how you're perceiving time, you know? So you think that less time, you know, has passed than actually has. So like, I'm always just underestimating how much time things will take me to do. So, like, I'm very, very guilty of that constant, like, I'm on my way out the door, and I'll be like, oh, I'm just gonna do this really quick. Like, it'll take me 2 seconds. Every time. I'm positive.
Nope. Never.
It never does. You know, I'm constantly underestimating, like, how long it's gonna take me, like, how long it takes to get there, and, like...
Yes.
And even Dr. Russell Barkley is one of the big, like, ADHD, you know, big wigs. And he's even said that he thinks, like, ADHD can be summed up in time blindness. Like, so yeah. much of it has to do with that, you know, because he says, like, what did he say? He says that, like, people with ADHD are constantly, like, never at the right place at the right time, you know, with the right things that they need, right?
No. You pick one of those things.
Yeah, like, exactly. They're just like, and that's why, like, we constantly feel like we're just living crisis to crisis, right? Like, because everything is sneaking up on us. Like, so we don't have the ability to really, like, hold this sense of a future and how much time is passing and how much is, like, you know, how long to go until we, how much time do we have to complete these things? And so, yeah, it's just a huge impact of it. And it's why we're just, like, you know, constantly frazzled. It's like we can never expect anything, even if they are very predictable obstacles like traffic, you know, like
right.
traffic will always just, you know, completely unravel me because it's like I can never, I can expect it. I know it's coming, but how long it's going to take and how it like impacts what I'm doing in the present is just, it doesn't right. connect. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In fourth grade, we started doing the timed math tests. So imagine me with my, what I now know is dyscalculia plus time blindness plus ADD. I was a nightmare. I was just a complete nightmare. I remember it specifically one day, just like, finishing last, not even being, I was nowhere close to being done with my times tables. And all of my classmates were outside playing and I could see them from the window. And it was that classic like movie moment of the camera, like looking at the shot outside the window and all my friends having fun and then panning to me. And I'm just sitting there staring with an empty times table in front of me.
Oh,
and Mrs. Stupid. Layton, God rest her soul, being like, Starlisha, what is wrong with you? She called me slow. She was like really awful.
Oh no.
Yeah, not great. Which contributed, I think, a lot to why I hate math, because I couldn't do my times tables and she called me slow in front of my class.
Oh my god.
I'm like, listen, just because it's true doesn't mean you have to say it out loud. So yeah, I think I also wonder a lot with time blindness, like there's this thing that went around a few years ago, and I mean, it pops up like here and there. Everyone's like, you know, I think like being rude is the, or being late is the rudest thing a person could ever be, and da 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 da. And I'm like, y'all don't understand. I think I'm on time 90% of my time. Like, I'm like, oh, I'll be fine. And then suddenly I'm 16 minutes late to being where I need to be because I haven't left early enough, or like, I don't know. And I often wonder too, like, because I don't drive, I wonder if my time blindness would be worse or better if I had a car and a driver's license. I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, if I had a car, I know it takes about 7.5 minutes with very little traffic to get to my job. If I had a car, would I leave 7.5 minutes earlier than I do when I take an Uber or when I walk or whatever? And I'm like, I don't know that it would matter, because you're exactly right. It's that moment of like, you're almost out the door and you're like, oh, I just have to do this one thing. Like, oh, I have to feed the cat, which turns into picking up the cat, which turns into standing in the middle of the kitchen singing to the cat. And then you're like, okay, now I have to go, and 6.5 minutes has elapsed. And you're like, what happened?
Yeah.
Like, it just, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's and tough.
It's hard. And also, too, like, dating. That makes dating really hard.
Yes.
The amount of dates I've been late to in my lifetime have been many. And the only person who has ever adapted well to that is David. And I don't know if that's just because, like, we now know each other so well, and we've known each other for almost 4 years, and now he's just, like, used to me being late. But a few weeks ago, I have no idea where we were going, but a few weeks ago, he did the thing where he lied to me about what time we needed to leave, and it worked. Because at the last second, I had to, like, do something. Who knows what it was? I had to do something. And I, like, vaguely noticed that he wasn't frazzled by it. And then we got in the car and we got to wherever we were going. And I was like, oh, hey, like, da-da-da. And I was like, oh, you lied to me. And he was like, I did, and it worked. And I was, like, blown away at the fact that this was just a few months ago. Like, after almost four years, he actually did it, and it worked. And I'm like, but then that becomes, like, I don't want people to be constantly lying to me about what time we have to leave, because then I'm going to catch on to it, which David probably knew, which is why he doesn't do it often. And then I'm going to be like, no, you're lying to me. I actually have 15 extra minutes, which then, of course, turns into, I have extra minutes to do things, which turns into me being late, so.
Yeah, that's tough too. Cause like I think Hum has, I don't know if she's done that, but I think I've told her to, but then like, it's just this constant like argument with myself, or I'm like, yeah, tell me earlier. But then I'm like, oh, I can't believe you would do that to me. Like, I'm not a child.
Right.
Like, oh. And I'm like, yeah. I suggested it, you know, like,
it's like, why would you take my good suggestion and make me feel like a toddler?
Yeah. Then I'm like, then it's always like this. I'm very, probably partly because of rejection sensitivity, I'm very sensitive to being left out and like people having conversations without me. And so, like, that idea that people are, like, collaborating in cahoots about what time to tell me just makes me want to crawl in a hole and die. So, it's just no winning, you know. All the clocks in my house are 10 minutes fast.
But, does that work?
I think it does sometimes, you know, especially in the moments when you don't, when you're just, like, quickly just trying to, like, oh, yeah, do I have time to do that? Okay, yeah. When you're just like quickly looking at it instead of when you have time to look at it and be like, I know that's not real. You know, if you don't give yourself that time, I think it does work. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, but it's tough. Yeah. But the rudeness thing is huge. Yeah. I always take it very personally when people complain about, you know, how it's so rude that someone would be late and,
I'm just like, you don't understand. Yeah. I'm not trying to be late. I'm actively trying to be maybe on time.
Yeah.
That just not works. I want to touch on something you said, because this is something that I just taught a friend of mine. And they were like blown away about learning of rejection sensitivity and how that manifests. And I'm particularly interested in how that manifests in people who were assigned female at birth and like what that looks like for us. So I don't know if you want to like kind of give a brief definition.
Yeah, happy to. So that's it's basically exactly what it sounds like. It's a heightened sensitivity to rejection. It's also often referred to as RSD, which stands for rejection sensitive dysphoria. And dysphoria just means difficult to bear. So it's, you know, it's pretty self-explanatory in that way. It's kind of unclear where it comes from. There are some experts that believe it's inherently a part of ADHD. I think that does make sense just because it's, you know, we're hypersensitive to almost everything. So I think it would make sense that would fall into that. But there are other people that say it's like a co-occurring condition because it is seen in a couple other conditions like autism and borderline personality disorder or complex trauma. So it's seen in other places. So it's unclear where, you know, is it, if it's in its own thing or is it, you know. But I do think it's really telling that I read a statistic that almost 100% of people with ADHD report experiencing it. So I think that's pretty telling that there is at least a very strong connection. And in terms of where it comes from, that's also kind of, I mean, I don't know if it's under debate because I think that a lot of the way we approach it would be the same no matter what. But some people, again, like just say that it's a condition and it's part of ADHD and that's how it is. And then some people say that actually it's not a condition as much as it is trauma. You know, coming from the trauma of being neurodivergent and being different and, you know, I always like to bring up this another statistic from the same researcher, William Dodson. He's estimated that people or kids with ADHD receive something like 20,000 more negative comments by age 12 than neurotypical kids. So it's considerable, like the difference in how we're treated. And I think it does make a lot of sense that like we're objectively rejected more, you know? So like, I see that being significant. Ultimately I'm like, does it really matter where it comes from? It's a thing. That's all we really need to know. There are a couple medications that sometimes can help. They're like less, the couple of the medications that I know of are actually, I think they were probably originally developed for blood pressure. I don't know if that's related at all. Yeah, it's clonidine and guanfacine. And they're both often used for PTSD as well. I think there's a lot of overlapping there. But I think in terms of how it relates to those assigned female at birth, I think like... there's a couple things. I think for one, I do think that just societally we face a ton more discrimination and, negative attention and harm and threats to our well-being and our safety, more criticism. Mm-hmm. So I think that definitely comes into play. I think... in terms of how people with ADHD tend to respond to an instance where they perceive that they've been rejected or criticized, we tend to respond in one of two ways, either like by internalizing it or externalizing. So externalizing might be like a temper outburst, maybe even violence or anger. I think I read somewhere about 50% of people court mandated to anger management had previously undiagnosed ADHD. Wow. Were hugely represented in the prison population. And so I think that might be a big part of it. And then internalized is generally like, it looks like rapid cycling bipolar. It looks like a very immediate, mood change. Withdrawal, some people even get suicidal, very internalized depression and, self-hatred, self-criticism. So I think in general, I think both of us, I mean, everybody does both of those things. I think I do tend towards both of those directions. But I think in general, people, AFAB people tend to lean towards internalized. And partly, because there are, like we were talking about, increased, dangers to externalizing, for us that there maybe aren't for men. So, did I answer that? Okay.
Definitely. Yeah. I have the exact fear. Like, I'm so afraid of being left out and like, what do you do about, what do you do about that? You create a party wherever you go. So you're the one who gets to decide if you want to be involved or not. Right. And like compound RSD with being an extrovert.
Yes.
My life is just, and you can relate to that as, right? You're an extrovert. Right?
No.
No?
No, we've had so many debates about this. Yeah.
I don't know. Listen.
No, it's okay. I get it. I have like, and it's confusing because. Oh, is that why you're like, oh, I like Abby. She must be an extrovert. Yeah,
that's the only reason I've kept you around for all these
biased.
Years.
Yeah. No, I get it. But I get it because it's like, it is tough to have to be an introvert and also have such debilitating FOMO. So it's like, I don't have energy to do this social thing, but I literally don't have it in me, but I hate being left out. I hate that I can't do it.
Yes, we did just have this conversation a few weeks ago. I remember now. Yeah. Yeah. And I cannot relate to that feeling because I am just like, I can't believe I'm being left out. How could you forget me? How could you not invite me? I'm like at that level all the time. Or like, you know, my friends and I a few weeks ago planned to go out on a Thursday night, and halfway through the day, one of the friends hit the group chat and was like, I'm tired. And I was like, this was literally your idea for all of us to get together, and now you're bailing. And it just ended up with me sitting at work because like we were all going to meet up after I was done with work. And I was just like, okay, I guess I'll just go home and sit by myself. And I'm like, I was like almost crying at my desk because I felt so rejected. And then of course there was that little voice in the back of my head trying to tell me that it wasn't that big of a deal and that everybody has a right to like change their plans, which is true, but
still sucks. I was like, still
it
hurts.
Sucks, right? Yeah. So I often wonder what it would be like to be an introvert in that moment and just be like, oh, thank goodness I can go home and sit on my couch by myself, as opposed to me who's like, I'm going to go home and sulk and David's going to have to hear about it for an hour.
I actually feel like I've had a lot of those experiences. Like I feel like I'm more often crushed than I am relieved when that happens. Just because like I plan to be social. If anything, it's like, this was like, you know, like if like social energy was like a budget, you know, like I have very limited funds. Okay. And like I had already planned, I'd already bought a ticket for this social event. I bought a ticket of social energy and now it's falling through and it's like, what? I just wasted all this money on this social ticket, you know? So it's like, it feels even more deeply like wounding. So I always cry when people cancel plans. It's just kind of like, it's just going to happen.
Right.
You know.
Sorry, everybody. Yeah. No, I love that metaphor of buying a social energy ticket. That is very relatable. Although everyone, I don't know, I don't want to reveal too many of my deep, dark secrets, but everybody is always like, you're just ready to party at any moment. And I'm like, yes, but I'm also old now. So those moments have to be earlier in the evening and we have to have an end game in sight. Like if you want to stay out until 2 a.m., that's fine. But let me know at 8 p.m. and I will like show up. Absolutely. Like we will do it. Yeah. But yeah, like I already bought a ticket of social energy. I love that. I'm going to use that with your permission.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's similar to the spoons theory, too, right? Like, we have a certain number of spoons and have to decide how to spend them.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's definitely true, needing to know in advance what's going to happen also because of it ties back to the time blindness, right? Like, I need to know exactly what's going to happen and when it happens and when it's going to end because, like, otherwise, yeah, I need to know because my brain can't provide that fence for me. You know, so I really need that external support of like what to expect.
Yeah. Expectations are key for sure. Yeah. Because nobody likes the person who walks around feeling rejected all the time. I mean, it's like usually it's me, but like I don't aim to be that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been tough. In my past like year. It's been almost a year, I think October, with my current therapist. I think it's been a huge goal of like just, I'm realizing like how much energy and how many emotions I feel are directly related to feeling like I shouldn't feel the first emotion. You know, like I spend so much time and energy being like, well, I shouldn't be so upset about this. Like, this is ridiculous. You need to chill out. You know, no one likes you. No one likes someone who just like cries about canceled plans, you know? So like it's taken a lot of work and it'll take more work to just feel the feeling and not, you know, spend a lot of energy trying to undo it because it never works. I mean, it's never worked once in the 30 years. I'm like trying to convince myself I shouldn't be feeling that way. It has never worked. So.
I don't know. Okay. Let me ask you this. What has there. Okay. So let me start that whole thing over again. Have there been moments of liberation that you have found with your ADHD diagnosis?
Yeah. Is that the end of the question or do you have more?
Yes. And could you, if you feel led to share, could you share one or two?
Yeah. Whew. That's a good one. I think it was great. I just participated in like, one of my friends works for this kind of like group coaching company called Top Knot. And so they invited me to do an interview for them for September's self-improvement month. So they gave me a bunch of like interview questions and I wrote out responses. And one of them was like, what's a lie? What is it? What's a lie you believed and how'd you figure out it was a lie? Like how'd you, you know, what's a lie you fell for and why do you not anymore? And my answer to that was that, like, I always believed that I just was, that life was this hard for everybody. That, like, everyone just walked through life just, you know, being, like, just almost decimated by everyday tasks. And, like, I thought everybody had this much trouble and I was just weaker than everybody else. And, like, I just thought other people worked harder. I thought other people had better work ethic. I thought other people, like, you know, just were able to apply themselves more. Because that's something I heard my whole life is that, like, if you just applied yourself, you have a lot of potential, you know? So that's definitely something that I think, just now figuring out that I had internalized and didn't know I did. Because it's, like, you know, and it was just, like, that kind of silly thing of like, I would just like walk around, like trying to relate to other people. I'd be like, I mean, like we all feel like our head's going to explode when we vacuum, right? Fellas, like LOL, right? You know, right. And everyone's like, nope,
that's, can't really,
that's not universal. So I think I'm just now figuring like how many of those little things I have of like, those little realizations of, it's not that I'm weaker. It's that, you know, cause that's what I always thought the answer was, is that like people would just constantly tell me like, this is easy. You know, this is easy. This is easy. Why are you having a hard time with it? You know? And I always answered that with like, oh, you know, I'm stupid. I'm lazy. I'm weak. I'm oversensitive. You know, I'm overdramatic. And that's how I always like answered that question. And now I can answer it by saying like, it's easy to you, like, and it's okay to have like, and there's no, I think another realization that I'm trying to liberate myself with is that like, there's no skill continuum, you know, it's not like there's like a ladder or a level of skill, simplicity that like, you know, we have to get to. It's not like, you know, I got a master's degree, but, you know, I have to Google how to boil an egg every single time, you know? So it's like, it's not that, you know, it doesn't negate my master's degree that I'm, you know, I struggle with this like quote unquote easy task, is that like everyone has their own skill continuum and that it's not something that is universal and it's not something that we can define what's easy for another person. I think that's, something that's been liberating about the diagnosis and learning more about it and learning more about like executive dysfunction, and how, you know, how that that shows up in my life and how, like, that's, I think I definitely have a lot of moments where I need to mourn that, and I need to, like, experience the grief of, like, man, I really wish this were easier for me. Like my, I just turned 30 a week or two ago, and, my dad's birthday is, like, just within a few days of mine. And he has a twin. So he and my mom and my brother all flew to Chicago, to spend it with his twin and to celebrate his birthday. And they invited me too, so that, you know, my birthday was around the same time that I could celebrate with them. And, like, I just, I was like, I can't do it. It was just for a weekend, and like, it just, the travel and knowing how incredibly taxing travel is for me, and airline travel, and like, and that it's very a quick turnaround. It would be like flying out on Friday and coming back on Sunday or Monday, you know, is like, I just couldn't handle it. And so it was very sad, you know, it's just like, oh, man, I really wish this weren't so hard for me. So I think that's okay to feel too. It's just kind of like, you know, it's okay that it's hard for me though, also. Right. You know. Yeah. So did that answer your question?
It does. I love that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Abby, tell us where people can follow you. Now's your time to plug whatever you've got going on.
Yeah. Okay. So my website is theadhdmanual.com. So that's the website. I'm on Twitter and Facebook at theadhdmanual. And that does include the, sometimes people leave that out. It's theadhdmanual. And yeah, my email is theadhdmanual@gmail.com. And my podcast is called the ADHD Manual Podcast. And we're pretty much, I think I'm pretty much everywhere. Like Apple, Spotify, Amazon. A lot of people get me on Podcast Addict, which I've never heard before. But I'm very popular on there for some reason.
Thank you so much, Abby, for jumping in with me. This was like a little impromptu, but also planned impromptu-ness.
We had it scheduled a long time, but we did. Thank you for reminding me.
Great to have you. Absolutely. Check us out on social media. Keep following us. And if you have any questions specifically for Abby or comments about today's topic, we would love to hear them. Thank you all so much for listening to the Peas in the Podcast. Peas out.